Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering the planned 2025 relocation of the Partners in Mission Food Bank.
Partners in Mission Food Bank is officially making the move to a new, larger space to accommodate for increased demand. Partners in Mission is currently located at 140 Hickson Avenue and has been there since 2003. However, as demand continues to rise in the Kingston community, with the organization helping over 8,000 Kingstonians in 2023, Partners in Mission now finds themselves in need for more space for storage, volunteers, and those seeking services. It has been announced that in 2025, Partners in Mission will be making the move just 25 meters away to 4 Harvey Street. I sat down with Dan Irwin, Executive Director of Partners in Mission Food Bank, to discuss the move. Partners in Mission is officially set to move to a new location. What challenges are you experiencing at your current location that made you decide this is a needed change?
Yeah, well, we're in what's going to be our fourth year in a row with record numbers, and we've just maxed out at what we can do here. Unfortunately, we're so full that our clients are unable to come into the building, so they're waiting outside in all sorts of terrible weather, and that's just not something we're comfortable with. So our new space is going to enable our clients to come inside. It's a shopping model, so they'll be able to choose the food they want. So it's going to be a much better experience for them.
And the new location is just a few meters up the street. How much more space will this provide? What's the jump here?
Yeah, so we're going to double our space. Our total square footage in this building is just around 8,000, and the new building will be 17,500.
Were the funds for this move achieved through fundraising?
Yeah, so we've known that this building had limitations and that we were growing so fast. So we've been trying to put money away. So that's what we've been trying to working towards. We're also fundraising right now to help with the renovations. We're looking for $1 million for our renovations. We're at right around the $350,000 mark. So we're still got a ways to go to help us to get these renovations paid for.
And you will still be at your current location during the busy holiday season. What challenges does that present, and what's the plan for the next few months?
Yeah, so right now you're right. We're at busy season, so it's going to get very full in here. We've got some awesome volunteers, 130 of them, who are doing their best to squeeze in here and there, and we're going to do that. That's kind of what we do here. We play the Jenga game, and we manage to get everything stacked up safely, and we still help the clients that need it. We'll be here until we're expecting a move date sometime in March. We'll firm that up as we get closer. We're just going to tighten it up, and we'll make it do.
How can folks donate if they'd like to support the move?
If they want to help support us, they go to kingstonfoodbank.ca, and there's a donate button, and right there they hit that donate button and make a donation to us. If I can also add, if anyone needs help, they should call us. We're in the busy time, so you need to call us as soon as possible, 613-544-4100, and that's Monday to Friday.
Once again, that was Executive Director Dan Irwin with Partners in Mission Food Bank, sitting down with CFRC to discuss the organization's move to a new and larger space in the spring. Partners in Mission is currently sitting just above the $250,000 mark on their way to fundraising $1 million for renovations. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Christina Laurie for that story. Up next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about a 12% increase in residential taxes in Gananoque.
Thank you, Jesse. Gananoque property owners face a 2025 tax increase of 12% as the budget process begins, an increase the mayor says is necessary to make up for the historic underfunding of reserves. The town of Gananoque's 2025 draft budget is now available for public consideration and review. Mayor John Beddoes noted that Gananoque's capital reserves have been historically under-resourced, and that since 2022, taxpayers have only averaged 50% or so of what should have been set aside. Since 2022, the town has managed to increase that amount to an average of about 76% of what should be set aside on residents' behalf, Beddoes added. New provincial regulations like the Community Safety and Policing Act, the requirement to run cameras through sewer lines in watersheds, and other safety measures have imposed mandatory costs onto municipalities, which the town has to fund through municipal property taxes, he said. Beddoes noted that the province is making Gananoque implement these changes and navigate the new costs that come with them. The town's asset management plan underscores the replacement cost of town assets, as well as the shortfall in contributions to capital reserves over time. Beddoes stated that council is facing a difficult decision year as the town must now figure out how to catch up on previously deferred works and capital contributions, coupled with new costs from the province. There are no easy answers, Beddoes added, and deferring necessary work is a poor option as the cost of service delivery and capital maintenance will only increase going forward. And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. And now over to Jesse Bell with a report by the LJI reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about a new agreement between the CHL and the NCAA that's benefiting the Kingston Frontenacs.
Thank you, Dinah. The Kingston Frontenacs announced the signing of forward Kieran Durvin to an OHL scholarship and development agreement last week, making him one of the first players to benefit from the new agreement between the Canadian Hockey League and the NCAA. Durvin, who plays for St. Andrews College Prep School and was selected 86th overall by the Fronts in the OHL draft in 2023, committed to joining Penn State in November of 2023, with the expectation of playing out his high school career at St. Andrews. The new developmental agreement will now allow CHL players to join NCAA programs after playing in the CHL. This means that Durvin can now officially play in the OHL for the Frontenacs and maintain his NCAA eligibility. In a press release, General Manager Corey Cooper said the team is excited to have Durvin under contract, and it's something they've wanted to see happen for well over a year. Cooper added that Durvin should be a full-time member of the roster next season, but they hope to have him in the lineup before the end of the 2024-2025 season. Durvin had previously stated that he was willing to sacrifice his NCAA eligibility to play in the CHL, but now he won't have to. Another current Kingston Frontenac has announced their intent to join the NCAA post-CHL career. Former Montreal Canadiens draft pick Cedric Guindon announced that he was committing to the University of Vermont. Guindon formerly would have been unable to play in the NCAA and would have more than likely been looking to join a Canadian U Sports team or continue his career in Europe after having his rights relinquished by the Canadiens. With this new agreement in place, Guindon will benefit from the best of both worlds.
And thank you to Owen Fullerton for that story. Now over to LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about a 7% increase in residential taxes in Loyalist Township.
Residential property taxes are set to jump 6.98% in Loyalist Township, with its 2025 budget on the way. The third and final meeting regarding the draft budget took place this week, with the final budget expected to be adopted on December 10th. The increase in residential property taxes comes from a $23.57 million levy requirement within the budget. Treasurer and Director of Finance Shelley Stedall explains the increase.
The levy requirement is the $23.5 million, which is a $2.1 million increase over 2024. And that increase in just the levy is a 9.9% increase. Now, when we apply the market value assessment that's levied by MPAC, we come up with just a residential township tax rate that would be re-increasing year over year 6.98%. So 6.98% is the tax rate increase that people would actually pay on their tax bill or just the township portion of their taxes. That's how much it would increase at the current proposed 2025 draft budget.
The budget also includes funds for local transportation services, including $1.4 million for Amherst View Transit and $7.9 million for the Amherst Island Ferry. Capital projects will receive nearly $9.5 million to address infrastructure needs. Staff noted they will be making an application to the Green Municipal Fund to fund 80% of a feasibility study estimated at $150,000. They will also be applying to the Township Community Grant Program to fund the remaining 20%. Councillor Carol Parks spoke about the impact of the township's physician recruitment program.
In 2023, council approved the establishment of the program to try to recruit family physicians, which was for $100,000 per physician over 5 years. Ideally, we had budgeted one additional physician every year, and that was to come out of operating, and initially $60,000 was applied for from the community grant fund. We were fortunate, I would say, in that we got three physicians in the first year, not just one. And so we have committed through agreement to fund for three physicians who have taken over for retirements at the Loyalist Family Health Team in Amherst View, which we're very fortunate that those patients did not lose their family physician. That only leaves us $20,000 in the budget. So initially, if council wanted two additional physicians coming up, it would be an additional $40,000 on that. But staff made the cut, and so removed one of them. So right now, the budget currently includes $20,000 for an additional physician in 2025 to be able to pay for the recruitment of one more in 2025. So the $20,000 savings is for what's currently in the budget to be able to offer the physician recruitment incentive program.
Corporate communications manager Trevor Cornelius explains the importance of public input.
We've had those conversations with the finance team and the communications team. I think going into next year, there's a broader range of tools that we can incorporate and use with this platform, such as like participatory budgeting and having budget sliders so people can identify or allocate preferences in terms of how they would like to see funds allocated. So I think there's more opportunities to have resident impact on those results, because it is easy to say you don't want the taxes affected, but sometimes there's choices that have to be made, and it'd be nice to involve residents in that process as well.
Councillor Paul Proderick spoke about wanting to see more public input in the future.
The results are tilted in one direction, obviously. So nobody wants the taxes to go up, obviously. But give them that section to say, well, what would you cut? Because I think that's the central issue here, is nobody wants their taxes to go up. And it's easy to say, right? But what are the alternatives for the general public? And that's something I'd like to see down the road.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Next is the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about the first Hoarding Action Response Team Coalition training sessions being held for public service workers in Prince Edward County.
Hoarding is not a clutter problem. It's not a laziness problem, but it is a thinking problem and a mental disorder recognized by the World Health Organization. And sadly, it is on the rise. It is estimated that 2 to 6% of Canadians have a hoarding problem, with most being over the age of 60. Recently in Prince Edward County, Hoarding Action Response Team Coalition, or HARD as it's known, held a training session where over 90 people attended that was a mix of first responders, social and mental health workers, and others. Several people came from as far away as Peterborough and Cobourg to learn about hoarding, the fire, disease, and biohazard dangers of a hoarding situation, and how to handle working with persons that hoard. Attendees heard presentations from a mental health expert, sanitation specialist, and an animal welfare inspector, who all stressed the need for workers to use personal protective equipment. Sanitation specialist Ryan Stickley was asked about safety equipment, and he talked about the use of PPE and biohazard suits.
There's two really separate components of it, and that is things like wearing face coverings and wearing suits and wearing gloves when you meet somebody for the first time. Like if I came to your house for the first time, you invited me over and knocked on the door, I showed up in a suit and a mask and gloves, you're going to be like, what's wrong, right? And so these people feel the same, these clients will feel the same way. And so it can become a barrier to building that trust, to building that moment. The counterpoint to that is that if, Laura, if you're going into people's houses, or if your team are going into people's houses, is that if you go into the house and you build some, you feel safe, it's going to be easier for you to build some connection. And when you leave that place and you're going home to your family and you're not so worried about it, it's going to be easier for you to find the little bit extra for tomorrow to follow back up with that person. I think as far as practical application of what it looks like, you learn some things that work, you learn some phrases to use, and they almost all universally work. So when I enter a place and I put on foot coverings, they always say, oh, don't worry about it, or what do you need those for? I say, hey, really important for me not to leave anything behind while I'm here. But we can just change some of how we're presenting that information. I would make a plan, kind of an operating procedure when it's appropriate to have that first conversation, maybe not inside the house, because you're going to get a lot of information by standing by the door when they open the door, right? You can get a quick look, you can get maybe a smell, you're going to maybe notice that the person you're working with maybe smells like a situation or looks like a certain way. And then from that moment, we just say, hey, we want to have a conversation, but I want to do it a little bit back. Sherry's famous one is like, hey, I've had a bit of a cough for a couple of days, and are you okay if I just protect you? And they're like, oh my goodness, here's the first person I've met that cares about me, right? And then, you know, so those are all the things. We just change in how we're presenting the information to be able to give us that access. For each person, it's gonna work a little bit differently. I've just found, what I said earlier, by asking permission early and often, when people give you permission, they're usually pretty apt to be a part of that thing. And I just make it, everything is nonchalant. It's not a big deal. It's sort of a passing in conversation. And generally it always works out, right? Every time I put on PPE in a house, I've never had anybody be like, well, if you're gonna wear a mask, you can't come in here. Once you've identified that there's probably an issue here, we probably don't have to spend all day there. We don't have to crawl through everything on the first go, right? And so maybe the suit might not be necessary the first day, right? But some respiratory protection, if you've gotta get around, you gotta get into a space. I leave gloves in my pocket. I never tell somebody I'm putting gloves on, right? Nobody asks questions. You already built some relationship. You're in their house already. I put a glove on. Nobody ever asks a question. You're just gonna find what works for you. Outside conversation first, present information in the right way. I've had a cough. I just don't wanna bring anything into your house. It shows that you care about them. That care builds some reciprocal care and makes your job a little bit easier. That would be my advice.
HART was named and started about a year ago in Prince Edward County by Fire Prevention Officer Mike Branscombe. For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over now to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the replacement of a historic single-lane bridge in Northumberland County.
An old single-lane bridge in Northumberland County is set to be replaced with a modern two-lane structure, as officials say the 75-year-old bridge has reached the end of its life. Designs are being contemplated on the replacement of the Burnley Bridge on County Road 29 near Warkworth. I spoke with Denise Marshall, Director of Public Works for Northumberland County, about the current bridge and an upcoming information session on the new structure.
The bridge itself was built, as you said, in 1950, so it would have been designed to the standards of the day and the current sort of highway loading required at that time. It was and is a single-lane structure. So, again, while the road itself accommodated two lanes of traffic, it was only designed as a single-lane structure. So for lower volume traffic, as well as the types of vehicles that really were traveling the roads during that time, which again were smaller vehicles and not some of the same large vehicles that we see today.
Now, I've noticed throughout the county there are a lot of single-lane bridges. I've seen one in Campbellford that's been kind of replaced recently, but are there a lot of single-lane bridges in Northumberland County?
On county roadways, we don't have very many, and I don't know the number off the top of my head. As you said, we did replace two recently that were county-owned but were on lower-tier roadways, and so those were replaced with single-lane structures. But on county roadways, this is the single-lane structure, and I'm not even sure if we have any others that are on county roadways. But on the lower volume roads and the lower speed roads, it was definitely, it is common to find single lane structures, and they can still be suitable depending on, again, the traffic volumes and the type of traffic that are using those roads and bridges.
Okay, wonderful. So I imagine that the county undertook a feasibility study of the life of the current structure or the current bridge, and I would assume that feasibility study ended up saying that it's now reached its end of life. Am I correct in that assertion?
So we do biennial inspections. So every other year there are bridge inspections done on all of our structures. And that's done by structural engineers who review all of their structures and provide a condition rating. And we use that information along with a lot of other information around traffic volumes and the traffic usage and sort of what activities are required in that area to determine when those bridges need to be rehabilitated and replaced or upgraded. A standard bridge has a lifespan of approximately 75 years. Again, that really depends on the type of structure, the location, the wear and tear, what kind of maintenance has been done to it over the years. So that's a very much sort of an average that we use. And so, again, through sort of that assessment, this bridge was identified to require either rehabilitation or replacement. And as we reviewed it further and did some more in-depth review with our consultant, it was determined that this one really has reached the end of its useful life, and a full replacement is the most feasible and cost-effective option.
Okay, Denise, let's examine the current transportation needs that, or even what's going on that bridge. What level of transportation are you seeing? You seeing a lot more heavier traffic, a lot more flow, a lot more use? Kind of what are you seeing on that bridge right now?
So County Road 29 is a county road. Our road network is an arterial road network, so it's the road network is really designed for movement of goods and services, and typically has higher traffic volumes and speeds than collector or local roads. So this one is one of our lower volume arterial roads, but again, still has over 1,200 cars a day that use the structure based on our traffic counts from a couple of years ago. And we know with growth that we continue to see an increase of traffic on all of our roadways. So that's something that, you know, the traffic use has increased over the years and will continue to grow. And also being in a rural area, we also see agricultural vehicles use our roadways, and we also know that a lot of those types of vehicles have changed over time, and many are bigger, and again, sometimes have challenges when they're trying to go over single lane structures as well.
The move now is to go to a double lane ridge frame bridge. I know that the county is talking about some designs. What design, I guess, has the county settled on for what this bridge will look like?
So we will be doing a two lane structure, and again, it'll be a concrete structure. That's sort of the most suitable structure to, again, meet sort of the current standards, also to tie in with the surrounding area. We have to consider from a cultural heritage perspective as well, sort of as what was there previously, and try to stay with the same intent and same cultural heritage look as well. And again, it'll just provide enhanced safety and improved traffic flow.
In terms of environmental studies, navigable water studies, and accommodations, are there any of those accommodations that need to be made pre-construction of this new bridge?
So we ensure that we consult with all required agencies, conservation authority, any of the other provincial or federal authorities that we may require approvals or permits from. So that is done through the planning and design process, that we reach out and find out what is required, and if permits are required, we go through the process to make sure that we've submit those permits and then complete any required studies that may need to be done.
Okay, so then from my understanding, there may be a six-month closure of County Road 29 at the Burnley Creek Bridge. Are there detours planned, or how are you going to accommodate traffic flow for that?
Mm-hmm. So being a single-lane structure, and because we're going to be replacing it, keeping it open during replacement is a challenge. There's a fairly narrow right-of-way there, so to try to build a new structure beside it is not feasible, and trying to build a temporary structure really is also not feasible because of the property and the cost associated with that. So we would be looking at doing a full closure for the replacement. We are still in the design stage and working through what the construction timeline would be. So at this point, we would say a 4 to 6 month closure, but that would be refined as we get closer and have the design complete and tender and have a contractor on board to be able to confirm the timing. We do have a proposed detour route that we would be will be showing at the upcoming PIC, and have worked with the municipalities since a lot of that detour would also be going onto some of the municipal roadways. So it is a little bit longer detour route just given the availability of connectivity around it, but that is something that would be in place during the replacement.
And coming up in December, on December 4th, there'll be a public information session at the Warkworth Legion. I would imagine you'll probably discuss some of the stuff we're talking about now, but and hear public feedback. In terms of public feedback, what have you already been hearing from area residents?
So I don't think we've had a lot of public feedback yet. I know we do have our join-in page set up, join-in Northumberland, for public engagement. You know, I think a lot of the questions really will be around, you know, what is being proposed, and, you know, will it be single lane or double lane? What's the detour look like? How long will construction take? You know, a lot of those types of questions to understand, again, what is the impact to the residents in the area and those that use it, use that roadway as well. So I anticipate that those are a lot of the questions that we will get, and just questions around, yeah, what the design is and maybe some of the studies that we've done. That's what I'm anticipating at this point.
This is Dan Jones reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. And now over to Jesse Bell for the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Thursday, December 5th, daytime high of 3 degrees with a 30% chance of flurries throughout the day, dropping down to minus 8 overnight. Start of a pretty bitterly cold stretch of days for us here in the city of Kingston. Friday, December 6th, daytime high of minus 4, dropping down to minus 11 overnight with that 30% chance of snow. Saturday, December 7th, a chilly minus 4, only dropping 2 degrees to minus 6 overnight, 40% chance of flurries. Sunday, December 8th, we're going to see a daytime high just below 0. It's going to be hovering around that 0 minus 1 mark. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, December 9th, it's actually going to be an unseasonably warm day. I'm seeing daytime highs of 5 to 6 degrees, and that remains consistent going into Tuesday, December 10th, and Wednesday, December 11th. Both days are going to be unseasonably warm, hovering around the low double digits. We're looking at 7 to 8 degrees. And that's a wrap for your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Throwing it over to CFRC for your community concert and events calendar. This is Jesse Bell from CFRC 101.9 FM, and this is your weekly events calendar. On Thursday, December 5th and Friday, December 6th, the Kingston Grand Theater will host the State Ballet Theater of Ukraine and The Nutcracker. The performance features a 50-dancer ballet troupe, a brand new set, and over 200 exclusive costumes created especially for this production. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Tickets are available online via the Kingston Grand Theater website. On Thursdays, the Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. And of course, the Grad Club is running its free and hugely popular weekly trivia night every Thursday starting at 8 p.m. On Friday, December 6th, City Hall will be illuminated white and purple for the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women. White and purple ribbons are worn on this day to remember the 14 female engineering students who were murdered at L'École Polytechnique de Montréal on December 6, 1989, in an act of gender-based violence. It is also a day to reflect on all women whose lives have been harmed or lost to gender-based violence. Saturday, December 7th, marks the beginning of Downtown Kingston's free trolley and carriage rides program. Experience the magic of Downtown Kingston in winter. Pickup and drop-off is at Springer Market Square. And finally, on Sunday, December 8th, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., featuring food, artisanal crafts, and music. Have a concert or event you would like to add to our online and on-air concert and events calendar? Reach out today via CFRC.ca, and don't forget to follow CFRC on Instagram at CFRC Music.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us.